I'm Brian Russo, and welcome back to Coastal Connection. Coming up in just a bit, we're going to head far out into the Pacific Ocean as we follow a Maryland family on their sailing adventure around the world. But first, we'll hear a story of seafaring that goes back hundreds of years, a story that involves a sunken ship and a battle to preserve the maritime history of our region. It's the story of a ship called the Dubrock. It capsized off the Delaware coast during a freak storm on May 25th, 1798, 215 years ago this Saturday. The Dubrock lived on the seabed for nearly two centuries before being pulled to the surface. Now you can visit what's left of the ship and check out some of the artifacts that were pulled from the shipwreck. It's all kept at the Cape Henlopen State Park in Lewis, and that's where I headed on Wednesday to meet with archaeologist Chuck Fithian. He's been working on the Dubrock for more than two decades.
Dubrock is a real important link that sort of ties Delaware to the Atlantic. It ties Delaware to major events that were sweeping across Europe. And those events were the Wars of Revolutionary France, which had started in 1793 and would continue to roughly about 1801. And then they would be followed by the Wars of Napoleon. And they affected the United States. The United States was a neutral power. Its commerce was important. Its markets were important. So both of the warring parties tried to protect that or prevent it from being used by the other side. So Dubrock is a physical reminder of these important events that were really shaping kind of Western history at the time, and links Delaware directly to it.
Tell me about the night that it went down. I read in the history books that tells us that it was a kind of freak storm that took this thing down. Tell me about that.
Dubrock is a type of vessel called a sloop of war, and they were starting to become much more widely used than they had been. They'd been a part of the Royal Navy for a long time. But in this period, in the 1790s, their numbers expanded. And the British were using them in a much more expanded tactical and strategic way. So they were ideal for a number of different things. They combined firepower with speed, agility, shallow draft. So it made them very versatile class of warship. It also made them very good for convoy escort. Remember, the American markets and resources are still real important. And the Americans and the British had decided to enter into a treaty to help protect that commerce, because the French were countering it by operating off the American coast, trying to interdict American shipping and disrupt that. And so the Treaty of Amity and Prosperity in 1798, the two countries entered into this agreement that the Royal Navy would escort merchant ships back and forth across the Atlantic. And that's what Dubrock was in the process of doing. She had picked a convoy up in March of 1798 in Ireland and was in the process of escorting it to the United States. She became separated from the convoy in a storm, but was in the process of working her way back up the United States, trying to reunite with this group of British and American merchant vessels. And on May 25th, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Dubrock pulls in off the Delaware Capes in looking for that convoy. The convoy had actually been here. It had departed about 3 hours earlier, from what we can tell from the historical record. Dubrock is coming to anchor when a very unusual storm system moves across the entrance of the Delaware Capes, strikes the vessel, and lays her over on her beam ends. And she fills with water and capsizes. Almost one half of her crew perishes in that accident. Those that survive, either were those fortunate who knew how to swim or to get up into the rigging, or were picked up by a Spanish prize that Dubrock had captured a few days prior.
Fast forward, of course, you know, the Dubrock ends up at the bottom of the Delaware Bay. You know, it sits there until the 1980s, and I find it very interesting about why it was brought up or why it was found, because, you know, legend had it that, you know, as with many ships of that era, you know, there's always the proverbial treasure hunt. And that was what people were going after. You know, of course, there was no treasure.
Well, Dubrock had acquired a treasure myth around it, probably beginning in the 19th century. The myth sort of started during the time when Dubrock had gotten separated from the convoy and she had picked up a Spanish prize. And the mistaken notion was the Spanish prize was a treasure ship. Yeah. And without really looking at the history and really what it said, the prize it did pick up was a common merchantman, and it had a cargo of coca beans and copper, which was no small thing in its own right, but it's not treasure in the sense of what everybody thought might be here. So that myth kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and maritime historians refuted it, mm-hmm. but the myth kept getting bigger. Yeah. And that's what led to the discovery. The real treasure, if you want to use the word, is the artifacts and the history that the Brock gives us an unparalleled look into. Mm-hmm. There's no other way right now that we could look at sort of seafaring in the Royal Navy, what it was like to be on a Royal Navy warship, what it was like to be on a sloop of war, in quite the same way that that the Brock provides for us.
As we stand here in this room at Cape Henlopen State Park, you've been working on this ship for the better part of two decades, almost three. Tell me about what we're looking at. This is one of the most striking visuals of a shipwreck that I've ever seen in my life. Just give people the description of what I'm looking at right now.
Well, the hull that survives, and I'll add that there's 20,000 artifacts of all different kinds associated, you know, with it. Approximately 30% of the lower hull survives. In other words, what we have is the keelson, we have the bow assembly, we have a portion of the port side, we have the starboard side surviving up to the turn of the bilge, in other words, where the hull begins to rise up and turn into the side of the vessel itself. There's also the futtock riders, the flooring timbers, the shot locker was in place, the bilge pumps are in place. Also associated with it is the vessel's copper sheathing, mm-hmm. which was not the newest technology, but still kind of cutting-edge maritime technology that was changing in this period. And then also the copper bolts that hold her together. That was a relatively new technology. The British were trying to find efficient ways to hold their ships together, to keep marine growth from attaching, and copper fittings was the solution to that.
It's amazing as we look at this, just and as you describe it, I'm looking at all of the parts that you're talking about, and the craftsmanship of this vessel is just astonishing. That old saying, they don't make it like this anymore. They don't make right. things like this anymore. Tell me how amazed you are, even after working on this boat, that this boat has held up, you know, at the bottom of the ocean for this long. And talk about the process of every day trying to just keep it from deteriorating, you know, and that leads us to the sounds that we're hearing of, you know, this vessel being watered several times a day.
Last year, we were able to take a big step in improving the conservation that we need to do for the hull. Right now, she's sitting up on a new sort of combination of wood and concrete support structure. The spray system is new. The water filtration system is new. So that was a big step. We need to keep it moving. There's other things that we need to continue on doing. But those are the things that we needed to do to sort of keep body and soul together. Mm-hmm. You know, right now, we have to keep her wet. The timbers were waterlogged for almost two centuries under the sea. And we just can't pull the water away really quickly, because what will happen is the sail structure will collapse and the hull will deteriorate. So we have to keep her wet, we have to figure out what sort of treatment we need to do, and then gradually start pulling the water away over a period of time, but we have to figure out what we need to replace it with to keep the sail walls from collapsing.
It's been said before that, you know, every boat tells a story, and certainly a boat like this, or a vessel like this that has so much history attached to it and can tell us so much about that time. Are you finding new things as you continue to work on this boat? Does this boat have secrets, and what else can it tell us about that time?
De Brock has been with us over 27 years, and we've learned a lot. The study of the collection is still ongoing. The study of the hull is still ongoing. So I think it's pretty safe to say De Brock's not given all our secrets up. She's given us a some unique ways of looking at what it meant to be a sailor in the Royal Navy in terms of their material world, in terms of their social world as reflected in the artifacts. Those are things that don't get recorded.
Right.
The Royal Navy was an immense bureaucracy at this time, generated just millions of records. But they're not recording necessarily what it meant to be a sailor necessarily in the detail that we would like to see today. Yeah. So the science behind the De Brock in terms of the analysis, the historical research, the artifactual research is in many respects ongoing, but she has provided us some really unique ways of studying seafaring in the end of the 18th century.
What was it like to be, you know, on this boat every single day? What's the biggest takeaway thing for you and the most fascinating thing for you about what it was like to be on the De Brock?
I think it's important to remember that De Brock is a Royal Navy warship. This is a military vessel. So she's being run by sort of different things that all have to intersect. You know, at one level, you've got sort of the social mores of 18th century England. Those have to work in conjunction with Royal Navy regulations. And they have to tie into shipboard practice, just the day in, day out of things that you have to do. You know, make sure the sails are okay, make sure she's not leaking. Mm-hmm. You know, the gunner needs to look at the gunnery stores and make sure the clothing's not molding and the issue of provisions and things like that. So you have those sort of levels, you know, that Brock represents. But you can also look at her in a sort of a broad anthropological sort of way of human beings in the sea, you know, what it meant to be seafaring at different times. We tend to kind of lump it all together as sort of, well, seafaring was seafaring, and it's really not. Seafaring in the age of the Mary Rose was different than it was during the age of the wars with Revolutionary France. And de Brock takes her place in providing key evidence to understand that in ways more fully than what we would have otherwise.
That was Chuck Fithian, a curator of archaeology for the Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs, speaking with me at the site of the de Brock. We've got information about how you can see this historic ship at our website, wamucoast.org.
When we arrive, sons and daughters, we'll make our homes on the water, we'll build our walls.
We'll continue this theme of adventure on the high seas by bringing you the latest in our LC Diary series. When we last checked in with Oxford, Maryland residents Richard and Jessica Johnson, they were crossing the Panama Canal into the Pacific Ocean. They've now started their long trek to New Zealand, and today we'll tag along as they sail to the Galapagos Islands and to Pitcairn, the island that's famous for sheltering the mutineers who revolted on the British ship the Bounty way back in 1789.
Hello, this is Richard on LC. We're sitting in Balboa on the Pacific side of Panama. We've just come through the canal, and we're getting ready to go out into the Pacific Ocean. I'll admit to some apprehension. It's about 6,000 miles before you can readily get parts and easily do repairs on the boat again. That's when you get to either New Zealand or Australia. So we're stocking up with parts besides food and water, diesel. So our first leg is to the Galapagos, relatively short at 800 miles, and then the long leg of over 3,000 miles will take us to the eastern edge of French Polynesia.
Here in San Cristobal, there are so many sea lions that they'll get in your dinghy, they come up onto your boat, they're all over the beach, or even walking down the street in town. There's a large male sea lion sitting on our step. Let's see if he has anything to say.
Shoo!
He really doesn't want to leave. Oh. They're a bit aggressive sometimes.
So we're still in San Cristobal, and we're walking along a path strewn with lava rocks, and it's an area called La Galapagaria, and we're looking for some giant tortoises. The tortoises are hanging out in the shadows of the trees. There's a mud hole where they can go and cool off if they need to.
Good morning, this is Richard on LC. We just started the longest leg of our trip to New Zealand. We departed San Cristobal in the Galapagos Islands last night, and we're heading in the direction of the Gambier Islands. Hopefully we'll make a stop there.
So it's been about 5 days since we left the Galapagos Islands, and we still have about 1,850 miles to go to our destination. On a boat, it's usually considered bad luck to write down your destination in the logbook or even to mention it with a lot of conviction. So I'm just going to say that we are somewhere in the South Pacific and we're headed somewhere else in the South Pacific.
Okay, LC, this is Kahiba relaying for the Magellan Pacific Net. Do you copy?
Cohiba, Cohiba, this is Elsie. I have no copy on net control. But
every morning and every evening, we've been talking to other boats that have formed what's called a radio net, and we come up on the same channel at the same time on a single sideband radio and give position reports and weather reports, and it's just a great exchange of information, and it's somewhat social.
With a speed of 8 knots, over.
Copy that.
So here we are somewhere in the South Pacific. We've still got about 675 miles to go to our destination. It's been a great trip so far. We've had pretty decent wind, which has pushed us along. We haven't had to use the engines at all. This is about our 10th day at sea, and I guess to be honest, everyone's getting a little bit stir crazy. Would like to get out and stretch our legs and maybe have a little time away from each other. But we've kept busy with Scrabble, with cooking, planning meals, with schoolwork, with catching and cleaning fish, and just sort of enjoying our time here being at sea. It's been my dream since I was a small child to visit Pitcairn Island. I guess I learned about it in probably a storybook telling of the mutiny on the Bounty. And sort of it's fascinated me that a small number of families had lived on this island over the centuries, and many of them are still here. It's a Tahitian English population that descended from Fletcher Christian and the original mutineers. I can't believe that 250 years ago, this island looked welcoming enough to Fletcher Christian and the other mutineers that they decided to stay here, to scuttle the ship Bounty and make Pitcairn their home. It's just not that friendly looking. So we've got our anchor down off of Pitcairn. We're going to get in the dinghy. We're going to dinghy around to Bounty Bay, which is the bay where the ship Bounty originally anchored and then was sunk when the mutineers moved ashore. It's probably going to be a wet ride. It's probably going to be a bumpy ride. Hopefully it's not going to be too treacherous getting into Bounty Bay, so that we can at least have a few hours ashore here. The weather is not supposed to settle down for the next 3 or 4 days, so today might be our best day to try and get ashore.
That was Jessica and Richard Johnson, who are sending us monthly updates about their sailing expedition around the world. This story was produced by Coastal Connection's Tara Boyle. You can check out previous stories in the series and find out where the Johnsons are headed next. Click to our website, wamucoast.org. You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm Brian Russo.